Our reading this morning is from our hymnal, number 477. And I will read it. You don't need to look it up. I'm just letting you know. It's a confession. Forgive us that often we forgive ourselves so easily and others so hardly. Forgive us that we expect perfection from those to whom we show none. Forgive us for repelling people by the way we set a good example. Forgive us the folly of trying to improve a friend. Forbid that we should use our little idea of goodness as a spear to wound those who are different. Forbid that we should feel superior to others when we are only more shielded. And may we encourage the secret struggle of every person. By Vivian Pomeroy. So there was a wise monk who lived high in the deep in the mountains of Japan, and he was known to be one of the wisest masters of Zen. One day he was home and he heard a pounding on the door, and when he opened it, there stood a young man who said to him, "I am very accomplished in the ways of Zen. I have studied with many masters and studied many books. But I have come to you because I have heard you are the wisest of masters to see if I can learn anything else from you." And so the master said, "Why don't we come in? Why don't you come in and we shall have some tea and discuss this?" So the master made some tea, and he took his teapot and poured tea into the young man's cup. And soon the cup was overflowing. And soon it was spilling into this young man's lap. "What?" he said. "They say you are wise and you don't even know when to stop filling a cup." The wise master said, "Your mind is like this teacup. You cannot learn when you are overflowing with knowledge. You must empty the cup." So we laugh and nod our heads when we hear such a story. We see the arrogance of that young student and the error of his ways. "Without humility, you are unable to learn," said Albert Einstein. "Without humility, you are unable to learn," said Laszlo Bloch, Google's former SVP of People's Operations, just a few years ago. "Successful, bright people rarely experience failure, and so they don't learn how to learn from that failure." What we've seen is that people who are the most successful at Google, who we want to hire, will have a fierce position. They'll argue like hell. They'll be zealots for their point of view. But then you say, "Here's a new fact." And they go, "Oh, well, that changes everything. You're right." It's intellectual humility, he says. Researchers in philosophy, theology, education, and business have studied and contemplated intellectual humility. The summary of their work is that for those who want to learn and those who want to seek truth, intellectual humility is critical. But what is intellectual humility exactly? I can't see you. Okay. Sorry, everyone. It's driving me crazy. But what is intellectual humility exactly? So one team of philosophers defined it as a disposition to own your own intellectual limitations. Richard Paul, author of The Art of the Socratic Questioning, defines it as, 1, having a consciousness of the limits of one's knowledge, including a sensitivity to the circumstances in which one's native ecocentrism is likely to function self-deceptively. And he adds, too, having a sensitivity to bias, prejudice, and the limitations of one's viewpoint. Robert Roberts, the distinguished chair for ethics at Baylor University, defines intellectual humility simply as the opposite of intellectual pride. He says intellectual pride comes in many flavors. For example, intellectual vanity is excessive concern to appear intelligent and knowledgeable to people whose opinion matters. Arrogance is a claim to superiority. Spugness is a preoccupation with one's accomplishments. Snobbery is satisfaction with one's membership in an elite group and a propensity to look down at those outside and below one's group. Ouch. You know, pride has never been my particular vice. I do have my own, but that's not been the one. However, I do recognize those flavors of pride from various moments in my life. Wanting people desperately to think that I'm smart, or feeling superior about something, or feeling kind of important because I belong to a particular group. I have experienced all of those. Perhaps some of you have as well. Ben Franklin, who worked hard at living virtuously and curtailing his vices, which he called passions, wrote, "In reality, there is perhaps no one of our natural passions so hard to subdue as pride. Disguise it, struggle with it, beat it down, stifle it, mortify it as much as one pleases, and it is still alive and will every now and then peep out and show itself." Why is this so? Asks Roberts. "Because pride feels good," he answers. I guess that's the thing with all the vices, actually. They feel good. It feels good when people whose opinions matter to think that you are smart and knowledgeable. It feels good when one feels superior. It feels good when one ruminates on all one's successes and accomplishments. It feels good to be part of an elite group and talk about those who are not quite as smart and intelligent and accomplished as we are. All these make a person feel special, and feeling special feels great. And we live in a world right now that likes to knock people down. And it is great to feel special and feel something that helps us so that we don't feel knocked down. Pride, however, is considered a vice. And Roberts calls pride the vice of self-importance. Feeling important itself is not necessarily a vice. Most of us want to be important members of our families and our workplaces and our communities, and this is not pride. This kind of importance recognizes our significance in a web of relationships. It recognizes that we each have gifts and talents to offer our communities. We are important, however, in our relationship to others, and how we act in relationship matters, and that is not pride. Self-importance, though, pride, places us in a position above others. We are smarter, more knowledgeable, and more educated than other people. We are better. And that is the reason that pride is a vice. Self-importance fogs the space between ourselves and others. It fogs our ability to access new knowledge and experience and understandings. The fog easily becomes reflecting, sending back to us our own perspectives and opinions. When we are proud, being someone who is smart and knows things becomes more important to us than learning something new. That is the overflowing teacup. The young man wanted the Zen master to know how much he already knew, how accomplished he was, how smart he was. And that was more important to him in that moment of introduction than trying to be curious about what this master might know that he did not. In its lightest forms, intellectual pride can keep us from being curious and learning. And in its most dangerous forms, it makes us inflexible, biased, and prejudiced. Richard Paul defined intellectual humility as being conscious of the limits of one's knowledge, including a sensitivity to circumstances in which one's native egocentrism is likely to function self-deceptively, as well as having a sensitivity to bias, prejudice, and the limitations of one's viewpoint. When we believe our own knowledge and intelligence is superior to others, it can be really difficult to be sensitive to our own bias, prejudice, and limitations in viewpoint. The fog of importance clouds our minds and makes it very difficult to accept something outside our experience or outside our construction of reality. Intellectual pride can impair us so we can't accept theories and paradigms outside what we learned on our own or in school or in our families. Intellectual pride makes it very important not to be wrong or to fail. Being right becomes more important than learning and finding the truth. Sharing what we know and our expertise is clearly important. We would all be much poorer if we did not share our knowledge, the knowledge and expertise that we have with each other. We would all be much poorer if we did not share our cognitive gifts with each other. Intellectual humility is not about being silent about our own experiences and our own knowledge and not sharing our gifts. Intellectual humility is knowing that it takes knowledge and experiences of many people to get to any kind of truth. And that is the moral of the blind men and the elephant. No one of us can know all of the truth on our own. We have limited experiences and knowledge and perceptual and cognitive abilities. Albert Einstein said, "As a human being, one has been endowed with just enough intelligence to be able to see clearly how utterly inadequate that intelligence is when confronted with all that exists." Humility is owning our own limitations. Intellectual pride is really common. I'm sure you're aware of that. And it fills the stories of history. Think of those who first suggested that the world was round or that the earth went around the sun instead of the other way. According to the people of the time, the people who presented those ideas were simply crazy. And scientific breakthroughs often include stories of some people refusing to believe the new evidence. If they did, they would be wrong. The way they thought about the world for their entire careers or lives would be wrong. And oftentimes what we think and how we perceive the world gets tied up in our identity. So how could someone accept that new information? It would be shattering. The intellectually humble leap a little more easily because being right isn't an issue. The truth is what's interesting. Or maybe not even the truth, just fascination about what's next, what you can learn now. For the humble person, the importance of oneself and one's knowledge isn't there. They do not identify with what they know and how smart they are. Intellectual pride can sometimes be obvious, but sometimes it is so subtle that we do not recognize it at all. According to Ejimo Oholuho, the author of So You Want to Talk About Race, it is common, for example, for white people, including smart progressive white people, to dismiss the life experiences of people of color as well as their interpretations of their life experiences. So when a person of color describes, for example, the experience of walking past a help wanted sign to pick up an application for a job and are told, oh, that job's no longer available, and then express to their white friend how angry they are about the racism in that act, a white friend might say, I guess often says, oh, you are overreacting. You probably really just hadn't taken the sign down yet. According to authors of color, this dismissing of their experience as overreaction is really common among their white friends. If a white person hasn't done a lot of anti-racism work and education and has been immersed in communities of color, what their black friend is describing to them is completely foreign. It doesn't fit within a white person's experience. It doesn't fit within our understanding of the way the world works and of history and society that we learned about in school, since the racial perspective is not typically offered in schools. Since the smart, progressive, educated white friend feels proud of their intellectual understandings and analysis of the world and very confident in that, and their black friend's analysis doesn't fit in, the analysis is dismissed. The white friend is not a bad person or uncaring. It's that fog of self-importance, however, that gets in the way of being able to recognize their black friend's ability to name and analyze their own experience. 2,500 years ago, Confucius asked one of his students, "Do you think that my way of acquiring knowledge is simply to study many things and remember them?" The student said, "Yes, isn't that the case?" Confucius replied, "No, I have one principle which I use like a thread on which I string them all." Confucius was correct about how our minds work. Neuroscience has shown that. We do make threads, theories, constructions of reality, and string knowledge on them. People have a worldview, and anything that contradicts that view is considered an anomaly or irrelevant or dismissed until the contradicting evidence is so forceful that a person or many people change their minds. However, some never change their minds. For them, being wrong is not acceptable, or perhaps shifting worldviews is too painful and difficult. One of the bits of data that has really fascinated me in this last election is the analysis of the people who voted for Trump. The media and many of us tell the story that Trump supporters were mostly white, uneducated, and working class. The bias of many who lean left politically is white, uneducated, working class people aren't that smart, don't think things out, believe religious nonsense, and respond to emotional appeals. That the Trump voters were mostly uneducated and working class simply is not true, however. According to the Washington Post, only a quarter of Trump's voters had both incomes below $50,000 a year and no college degree, which is a fairly standard definition of working class. A full third of Trump voters made over $100,000 a year. It is true that Trump voters were not as educated as Clinton voters. It is true, but it is also very true that lots of educated people voted for him. 30% of the people who voted for him had bachelor's degrees. 70% of Trump voters had no college degree. But most Americans don't have college degrees, Republicans or Democrats. 70% of Americans do not have a bachelor's degree. 60% of Americans have no college degree at all. Lots of people without degrees voted for Clinton and for Trump. However, the Confucius thread that reads in the minds of some people that the uneducated and poor are not smart easily interprets the election results in a way that places responsibility for Trump's election at their feet. This is a very subtle intellectual pride, unexamined confidence in our own stories about how the world works, and it fogs up analysis. The wealthy and the educated did vote for Trump. However, if the analysis is that it was primarily that the uneducated and poor voted for Trump, which I hear in the media and from people all the time, we are not inclined to go further and be curious about why was it all those educated and wealthy people did vote for him? Because instead, we just dismiss them as an anomaly. They don't fit in the worldview, in the picture. And the consequences are very real for beloved community. Once when we write off a demographic group as not smart, it creates an intellectual pride that creates a fog and our ability to see people in another group clearly. When it comes to this type of intellectual pride, our brains absolutely work against us. One of the things that our left brain does is it makes up stories. It creates explanations. It is so happy to do so. It will do this even with the tiniest bit of data. You have one little data point, and it'll create a whole story around it. It takes all those threads and all those constructed realities we already have and creates an explanation, a story about what happened. In many white people's experience, for example, we just know that business owners are mostly good people and wouldn't lie to a black person about job availability. It just doesn't make sense. It's crazy. When we feel superior in our ability to create a true story to explain things that happen, it can become really hard to shake. It's kind of a blow the conscious radar. So if you're white, it becomes hard to understand a black experience of poverty. A black person's experience of poverty is very different than your own experience of poverty or your friend's experience of poverty. If you are educated, it becomes hard to know how to listen and respect the stories of someone who doesn't have a college degree and may not have the same categories that we were trained to use to process experience. Intellectual humility is essential for learning and for growing. Socrates used to say, "I know nothing." It was a stance that allowed him to be curious and look at anything that came up. When we are willing to hear new information and analysis that challenges our old perceptions and admit we were wrong, we can create new threads and new stories in our minds about how things work. Unitarian Universalism is not a faith that leads with intellectual humility. The Unitarian side of our faith is descended directly from people who called themselves the saints because they knew they were the few rare people who were saved by God during Calvinist times. And if that isn't arrogance, I really don't know what is. Our religious ancestors started Harvard, and we've been on an academic year worship calendar since the very beginning. Because many of the original Unitarian ministers taught at Harvard and wanted a break when school got out. Our ancestors were the transcendentalists, after all, who are still studied as critical in the history of American thought. Unitarian Universalists like to be smart. We can suffer, I hate to say, from intellectual pride. However, we also hold at the center of our faith the seeking of truth and a desire for a world based on love and justice. We really desire the beloved community. And intellectual pride no longer serves us as a faith. It creates a fog that gets between us and others. It paralyzes our desire to dive deeper so we can get new perspectives and learn new things. Our search for truth and beloved community requires much more of us. It asks us to be humble. And I know how hard that can be. When I enter into a relationship or study of a topic and try to empty the teacup of my mind, my reaction is not in my mind, it's in my stomach. it turns anxiously without a mind full of knowing. I can easily feel empty and uncertain. I don't know my position in this situation. I don't know how to be, and I have no idea what's going to happen and what I will learn. And I don't particularly like to feel uncertain and not knowing what will happen. So my current practice is just to sit with that anxiety with love for myself and whoever else is involved. I don't know the way to a Unitarian Universalist humility, but I do know that we and our culture desperately need that humility. We need new ways of being in the world together to create more love and justice and beloved community. So I want you to know that I have a pretty empty mind about this path, and I am hoping to learn it all with you. So we do have time for some questions. You might have some.
Actually, the thought I had on the white guy with the it may actually be true what he said.
That it might be.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
That's the hard thing to remember. Whatever I say might be right. So what?
Right. I mean, in that case, you can't really know. But you can't. But some a person of color would just say, "There's a lot of." I mean, that's sort of the pattern. So, yeah, in that particular case, we can't actually know.
I moved here from the Midwest. The Midwest is quite disparaged out here on the West Coast. And my pride is that I come from the city that has the biggest Unitarian church in the nation.
Where is that?
Tulsa, Oklahoma.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Thank you, Tracy. This whole month where humility has been the theme has been really, has taught me a lot. And the very most pointedly educational thing about humility was performing a special music interlude. And it's not the lesson that has been repeated over and over through the month has been that it's not a matter of how good you are at the thing or how bad you are at the thing or proving yourself or being praised or any of that. It's taking that it doesn't, it's not about you. Like in my 20s, I tried really hard to be good at something, and it was, you know, it was ego. And whether I succeeded or failed, I mostly just felt anxious. And the cure for that turned out to be to do things that I was bad at, that I knew I would be bad at, so there wasn't the pride initially. Things that I had never tried before, so I had no expectation of being good at it. And then using that, how that felt, where it really was about the thing. It was about the skill or the body of knowledge or the art or whatever it was that I was interested in. And I forgot about myself. And I forgot about whether I was doing well or not. It was just about the thing itself. And that felt really good. And then I used that to sort of work on the things that I was proud of in a bad way. But anyway, just that humility is a matter of just forgetting about yourself,
yeah,
and being brought out of yourself.
Yeah. That's what Rick Warren says. He says, humility isn't thinking less about yourself, but thinking about yourself less.
Yes!
That's good. He paraphrased C.S. Lewis, who said it in a long paragraph. So,
so 25 years ago, I spent a year in Ecuador. And I remember they were kind of saying, hey, when you get back, you're going to have all these great stories, and you're going to have this year of experiences that people around you didn't have, and you're going to want to tell them all about it, but they're going to look at you and go, oh, great, I got 4 new tires. And that really struck me. And, you know, and anytime I'd come back and go, oh, you know, my life is doing something completely different, and they don't So me telling all these stories to somebody who can't relate is really interesting. So it stuck with me all those years.
Thank you, Tracy. It was a wonderful presentation. I just wanted to echo what Kim was saying by way of practice of humility as performance of a musical interlude at Woof. And I was asked at the last minute to perform earlier this month, and I had a very boring sonatina ready, or I had something that by Beethoven that wasn't quite ready, but I stepped forward in the spirit of the month, and I have had such wonderful comments on my less than perfect performance. It made me really appreciate the spirit as opposed to the technical expertise or whatever. And thank you again for bringing us this topic for the month.
One quick data point. The Unitarian Universalist Church in Portland is the fifth largest Unitarian church in the United States.
So we can be rightfully proud we share the city with them.
When struggling to even be monetarily paid for the gifts you have to give and be sustainable and not burn out, it seems like you're asked to find some kind of a confidence, or some of the language seems more prideful that you're supposed to step into, but maybe I'm not correct there. I just am trying to find the balance with marketing, what I do, and learning how to be professional and fit into these expectations so that somehow what I have to give is worthy and deserves monetary support, and me believing that all of my experiences are worth monetary support so that I can eat and have a stable home. It's such an interesting balance to step into that and find the balance.
Yeah, our culture, that's a challenge.
As another data point, the church downtown is actually First Unitarian and has always rejected adding the name Universalist. And in my experience, our Unitarian heritage was a lot of white guys who spoke up and many abolitionists. But it was the Universalists who fought on in the trenches for the poor, for the disabled, and ordained the first woman minister. So I think that, you know, when we look at our faith, it's important to look to the Universalist in us.
I can just speak to that briefly. The Universalists are our more humble part of our faith. In fact, the Universalists really came out of poor communities, poor rural communities. This is where Universalist Church flourished, not in cities. And in fact, there was such an arrogance between the two that Hosea Ballou, who's considered one of the great Universalist thinkers, and he lived at the same time as Emerson and Theodore Parker, and they all were in Boston together, and they never met each other because Hosea Ballou had never been to college. You know, he kind of came up out of his people, and he was an extraordinary thinker, but he just was in this different thing, and they just didn't have the time of day. They just never communicated. So it's the Universalists that really are our more humble piece of our tradition. Thank you, Tricia, for bringing that up.
Yeah. Where Jim
No, Jim.
I strongly recommend that if you're looking to find humility, teach. You have to resign yourself to the fact that at least once a day you're going to make a fool of yourself in public.
How many Universalist churches are there in this country?
Universalist versus Unitarian Universalist?
Yeah.
I think that they, I don't know if there are any that are just Universalists. I know there's some who are Unitarian Universalists who have kept just the Universalist name, just like First Unitarian chose only to keep the Unitarian name. But those are pretty rare. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did combine in 1961 completely. Mm-hmm. And so even churches that, like First Unitarian is still a Unitarian Universalist congregation, as is. I have a friend who serves at the, what is it called? The Outlaw Bridge Universalist Church. And so they've only kept their Universalist name, but they're still Unitarian Universalists.
We had the quote from Einstein, and I'd like to point out that the last thing Einstein wrote before he died was an attack on the theory of continental drift, and he said that the matching coastlines on the opposite sides of the Atlantic were just a coincidence.
Oh, that's funny.
Speaking of the Unitarians and the Universalists, I don't know who said it, but we had a movie we used to show at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Mobile. We used to show this video to newcomers, and one of the pieces was that the Universalists thought God was too good to damn them, and the Unitarians thought they were too good to be damned.
Well, thank you, Reverend Tracy, for that talk that hopefully it got us all thinking about ourselves.